I don't want to be right. I want to thank Luther Ingram for writing and performing that soulful classic from way back in the day. And welcome to Stick to Wrestling. My name is John McAdam, and you are listening to the only wicked good wrestling podcast out there. You give us 60 minutes, we will give you an exciting podcast. I want to bring on right now my convivial co-host, Mr. Sean Goodwin. Sean, how are you tonight?
Well, first thing is, I think I caught that the hella flu that you got. You sent it to me through Skype somehow. So I will have to now apologize if I cough or something like that, but I'll try to get to the mute button quickly. And the other thing I'm annoyed about is everyone who did not. If you are one of those people who did not sign up for our Facebook page, you're the one I'm talking to right now. Okay, because this is what you missed. You missed an update from Don Morocco on Tony Garea's employment status. That will be very funny when you go see it. So I'll have that be the tease. You have El Santo in the ring, not the Jody Hamilton, the real McGilla, in a 1962 movie. We got a picture of Frank Gotch cinching up the Texas Cloverleaf. The Jet Set reunited. A discussion of Red Bastien's love of old timey mustaches. Results and pitches from the teens up into the 90s. Okay, this is what happened this week. That was just this week. So why are you waiting? You should be doing this now as you're listening.
Welcome to the Typhoid Podcast. Anyway, when this comes out, this is going to be released on October 25th, 2019. Couple of things. We talk about guys who have birthdays coming up. And on October 25th, Too Cold Scorpio turns 54. Perry Saturn turns 55. Happy birthday to two of those guys who kind of prove a point I like to make, Sean. No one knew who Perry Saturn was. No one knew who Too Cold Scorpion was until that Clash of the Champions. To me, there's no such thing as we don't have enough talent. Oh, my God, who are we going to put this belt on? Who's going to be the tag team partner? You go out and find guys. So Paulie Dangerously went out and found Perry Saturn and created one of the best tag teams, in my opinion, of the 90s, the Eliminators. And I thought they were unbelievably good. Too Cold Scorpio comes out of nowhere to blow everyone away to Clash of the Champions. The talent is out there, promoters. Just go out there and find it. Also, Brett, and this relates to last week's show. 20 years ago today, Bret Hart won the WCW United States title. And this is what I was talking about. This is why people didn't dislike guys like Piper and Flair as much as they like guys who went out of their way to sabotage another guy's push, because that's all you're doing with Bret Hart, putting a title like that on him. I think, Sean, you're probably not going to know this. I think Kevin Nash was the booker at that time. I think Kevin Nash knew what he was doing by putting that title on Bret.
It sounds like a Nash move.
Totally, yeah. Former Tennessee Volunteers center Kevin Nash. But anyway, we are having a guest. It is his first appearance on Stick to Wrestling. Oh, and this is our final mailbag show, kind of, or at least for a little while. The October of Inquiry is coming to an end. However, moving forward with Stick to Wrestling, if we know the day we record what we're going to be talking about, we'll mention it on the Facebook page. If you have any questions about that specific subject, throw it out there and we will try to get to it. And with that, I want to introduce, he's broadcasting all the way from Bangkok, Thailand. I am not kidding. He lives there part-time. He lives in Los Angeles part-time. My good friend, a really knowledgeable guy, Tony Caro. How you doing, Tony?
Hey, how you guys doing?
Doing really good, thank you. Thank you for taking the time and coming on. And a weird time.
Thank you for bringing me on.
Morning, where you are?
Yeah, almost. Yeah.
All right, cool. So we will start with the questions. Tony, what I would like to do, I'm going to ask the question. Because you're our guest, you're going to go first. And then, Sean, I would like your opinion. And then I'll slip in mine. Ian Totten, named after a town in Massachusetts. Assuming Crockett doesn't sell to Ted Turner, who does he get to replace Dusty as booker? Dusty was pretty burned out by that time. And it's imperative that he take a hiatus. Tony, what's your take on this?
Crockett was never going to replace Dusty. In fact, when they fired him, he wanted to bring him back. They were never going to divorce. And that pretty much means Crockett was going to go out of business sooner or later.
Sean, what are your thoughts?
I pretty much agree with Tony. But I will say who I think. Bill Dundee. Because we were talking about this earlier. Billy had a great eye for talent, great deal for developing talent. He, you know, he kind of developed the Rock and Roll Express. He helped with that whole Midnight Express feud over Mid-South. He was a successful booker wherever he went. I'd be interested to see what he could do on the big stage. He's not going to be a prima donna about the money thing. He works his ass off, and he's going to be willing to book without actually having to work too. And those are some of the best times he's booked is when he wasn't the top performer, like Mid-South.
That's a good point. Actually, I think he was in the ring at Mid-South, and with Dundee, that's one thing you would want to keep him away from. I would be like, Bill, if I were to bring Bill Dundee in as booker, I'd be like, Bill, you know, I'm happy to have you as booker, but you're not getting on television.
For that gig, I think you could talk Bill Dundee into that.
Okay. I'm going to answer this question in a two-pronged manner. Number one, if I had to bring someone in to replace Dusty, my first choice would have been Cowboy Bill Watts. However, as we know, Bill kind of struck a hard bargain, and just being the booker, you know, wasn't going to be enough for him. If I had to go with a second choice, it would have been Jim Cornette. And I would have actually wanted – whoever it was, to have a booking committee with the head booker making the final decision. But I want to get to something Tony was talking about. And I told everyone on the Facebook page, I'm going to go off on this. Tony is 100% right. When Crockett sold that promotion to Ted Turner, the first thing Crockett did was he was made a consultant, and he made it perfectly clear that he wanted Dusty Rhodes to remain as booker. And had Dusty not did what he did, he was told no violent angles and no blood, and he went out and did a violent angle where the Road Warrior stuck a spike in his eye and there was blood all over the place, and that was the end for Dusty. He would have gotten that gig at least short term. He would have at least gotten a shot to retain it, but he pulled that and he didn't. So back to Crockett. He continuously writes letters as a consultant, pushing them to bring back Dusty Rhodes. This is the only guy. But this is when Dusty was back promoting Florida. Dusty finally goes to the WWF. Crockett gets off it. And then Dusty manages to come back as booker at the urging of Jim Crockett. He was still at it towards the end of 1990. And finally, they agreed to bring Dusty back, and he did come back. But yeah, you know, Crockett was not, even though Dusty helped put Crockett out of business or forced him to sell, I mean, Crockett just never woke up and said, hey, you know, this guy's had a good run, but I need someone new. Any thoughts on that?
John said that Crockett's problem was Crockett himself didn't know how to book. So he would have to put 100% trust and faith into anybody that he hired. Dusty never double-crossed them, really. I mean, Dusty was a loyal employee. Crockett didn't know how to book these things on his own. To bring somebody in that could have, you know, could have pulled a stunt or tried to usurp him, that's probably why he probably gravitated a bit more towards Dusty. The problem was Dusty had to go at that point, or not even forever. He could have went away for a year, 2 years, and been brought back. But they were history wasn't going to change.
Excellent point. Sean, did you want to throw anything in on this before we move on to the next question?
I agree. This is an easy one because they're not going to separate. And Tony brings it. Bill Watts is right when he looks at it this way, that he basically can't book. So you have to, it's like a movie director who doesn't know how to do any of the other stuff. So you kind of have to go on faith what's going on. And sometimes that works if you have honest, good guys, and sometimes it doesn't work. But yeah, I would also agree that with Tony, he didn't betray him. I think Dusty just ran out of gas. I mean, you know, he had a long run there, and at the beginning, he was brilliant.
Here's the issue with Dusty. They say that Dusty learned everything from Eddie Graham. Florida ran 6 days a week. It ran multiple cities. So they're running a lot of angles, running a lot of titles. It's got to be fast because you got to move. Same thing with Mid-Atlantic, same thing with Memphis. When you're going into Cleveland and Philly and here, there, and there, and you're only going once a month, you need a WWF, you need an AWA pace. Dusty burned through too much so quick because he's booking half the territories running more frequently, other territories are running once a month. It's very disjointed. They needed another TV show for their one-a-month markets.
That is such an excellent point that Dusty grew up and learned how to book on a once-a-week schedule that Crockett was running every 4 or 5 weeks. Wow, thank you for that.
Well, John, a quick jump off on that point. What Graham did when he booked was he always had a guy, though. I mean, they went to the frantic pace, but he would have like a Watts or one of the Briscoes or Louis Tillett, one of these guys, Garibaldi, in there as kind of his guy, then move him out to kind of as a buffer to him to keep him fresh, per se. They did a similar thing in Memphis, too. This was Dusty for 4 years. I mean, you know, there's going to be a shelf life there at some point.
I mean, Watts learned how to book from Graham, too. And what did Graham? Graham knew how to book, so he could hire anybody he wanted. And if something was going off the wall, you're out of there. I mean, I don't know the story, but I think that's what happened with Buddy Rogers, what happened with Johnny Valentine. They would come in and they would be out.
Well, what happened with Rogers was, he put himself over, and Eddie Graham found out about it and got him out of there. So, yeah.
I mean, Watts did something similar. I mean, you know, he had Dundee as booker, he had Jake as booker, he had Eddie as booker, and, you know, but everything went through Watts, so he kind of had that, you know, right-hand man sort of thing. But yeah, really good point on that. And
Watts was a publisher / editor-in-chief. Crockett was a publisher. That's the issue.
You know what? That's a really good analogy. All right, Tony, going to drop another question your way. If Eddie Gilbert lives, this is from Dan Potts. If Eddie Gilbert lives, does he return to ECW?
Absolutely. Absolutely. He had the history going back. Not even, you know, Goodhart's tri-state. I mean, Eddie was, you know, big with UWF when UWF used to air on Saturday nights. And before that, he was a tag team partner with Gurria with the Backline. He had a very long history in Philadelphia. And also you had the shoot angle that you could work, you know, removal from ECW. So, yeah. And, you know, forget all that stuff about they had this, that, and such personal issues. I mean, you got to put people in the audience eventually, you know, or you're going to go broke. So, I mean, Eddie would have come back.
Sean, any thoughts from you?
No, I don't think him and Paul could work together. Paul kind of shivved him good. So I don't think so. What I think would happen with Eddie would be that he would turn into one of the best behind the scene guys that, you know, one of the best like road agent kind of, you know, semi bookers in the WWF. And you would have about five or six guys giving future Hall of Fame speeches, crediting him for getting them there.
Okay, so we have a definitive yes and a definitive no. And here's the thing.
And a definitive, nobody really knows.
That's a good point, too. I want to throw this in, and it's here's the thing. Sean, you said that Paul shivved Eddie good. There are two sides to that. That's the Eddie side, that Paul went to Todd Gordon and said, you know, hey, I could do a lot better job than this guy. And he charmed his way into the booker's seat. The other side, and this is Todd Gordon's side. Todd Gordon has said that he independently decided to move on from Eddie Gilbert and try Paul Lee as booker. Whatever happened, it was a seriously bitter split. Paulie Dangerously and Eddie Gilbert were best friends for, I want to say, at least a half a decade before all of this went down. And, you know, Eddie felt like Paulie stole the job from him. And I don't think those two ever got along again. To answer the question, if he did not die in 1995, would he have eventually wound up back in ECW? I got to think yes, because it would have made just too much sense. I loved Eddie Gilbert, but I have a hard time seeing him catching on in WCW or WWF. I think, you know, just forgiving and forgetting, and like Tony said, maybe working a shoot angle. There was just too much money on the table for both sides, and both sides kind of needed each other. Tony, any parting thoughts on that?
Eddie was working in WWC. ECW would have been a big step up. And, you know, ECW was honestly, it was a stepping stone to a guaranteed contract somewhere else. And WCW would have hired him just to put somebody on TV because of all the time they had to fill. Eventually, I mean, he would have put everything away with Paul because he knew the big Tay Day was coming. If not in ECW, a year later, 2 years later. And he needed to get back on TV.
Good point. Sean, any thoughts from you on that?
You brought up the point. That was Eddie's story. That means that's what Eddie thought. Eddie thought he got shivved. I like I said, from back in the day, what I heard, it was like I said, it was bad, bad blood. And I'm just don't know. There were a lot of people who swore Paul off and didn't come back.
Yeah, that's true. And I mean, like I said, you know, Todd Gordon says, no, it was all my doing. But who knows
what's he gonna
if
say?
That's actually true. Exactly. What else is he going to say? All right. Frank Conan. All right. I always miss these. Not this time, pal. So what early 90s indie promotion besides ECW, Smoky Mountain, or Memphis did you think had a chance of making a big impression but never did? Furthermore, was there one of those that you thought did better than you imagined? I'm going to hand it over to the guest, Tony.
I'm going to say something a little off the wall. I think with the right distribution, FMW could have gotten its videos into the market somehow, and I think they could have did some indies just because of the crazy factor. I don't see too many indies out there that were, you know, that really did have a chance of making a big impression because they didn't have the production values, they didn't have the budget. You know, FMW could at least afford something, and it had a gimmick that other promotions didn't have. And then, Onita was very charismatic. I mean, he could cross over.
You know, I've never thought about that. Like, it's you already have the wrestling produced. Why not just bring it to the United States and put that stuff on, you know, UHF stations late at night? I think that could have been a big success. Sean, go ahead, man.
FMW's production values were excellent. It wasn't Wing. It wasn't IWA. It looked good.
Yeah.
Go ahead, John.
No, I was going to say, I want to say 91, 92, my friends were over at my place playing cards, and I put in an FMW tape, and they were just like, oh, wow, wrestling's real in Japan.
Was it the Dynamite match that made them think that?
I don't exactly remember. But
me? No. I can't think of one. And the reason being is that what these guys either did was one of two things. The first was they would be an impersonation of either ECW or WWF, which just couldn't
exactly
work. You couldn't outdo them at what they did. So that was problem one. The other problem was, and these are the guys who were successful, but they had a localized product. So now – these guys, you know, a little place like Bose Southern States and stuff like that, they have a very good product that was localized to that region, like an old territory was. So, I mean, but that was kind of why it works, because you kept it that way and you didn't push the expansion to the point where you would become a WWF junior or something like that. So for that reason, I don't think there's anything that could, you know, really catch on nationally per se.
Yeah. I mean, I think the goal back then was just to do a territory rather than do a regional. Sean, when you were talking, another one jumped into my head, and I'm trying to think of the name of it. It was the promotion that had like Paul Jones and Ricky Steamboat in the Carolinas, and they had Ken Shamrock. You guys remember the name of that?
South Atlantic.
Thank you, South Atlantic. And, you know, that was for a market that clearly was missing their pro wrestling. So that's one. I'm going to throw one, a really off-the-wall one at you guys. People forget that in 1990, when Paul E. was booking it, ICW was actually really good. And it didn't last that long. But it had some distribution, and when Paulie came in, it seemed to have a little bit of momentum going for it. And then he left, and it fell apart again.
I'd add kind of a mystery and a question mark, a Windy City Wrestling. They had some crowds that were pretty sizable, and then it disappeared. And they were in a good, perfect market. They were in Chicago. They could have duplicated the Philly thing, but probably weren't making money, or maybe there's something else going on.
Yeah, I believe it or not, I actually attended a Chicago Championship Wrestling show in 1989. It was a lot of fun. The promoter was really cool. I'm trying to remember his name, and I can't. All right. Just for Mike Fahey, just seconds ago, I finished watching the third episode of NWA Power. So I'll ask, what do you guys think of it so far? Have you seen it, Tony?
No, I haven't seen it. I usually binge watch stuff like that when I get a chance. All I can do is say I wish him a lot of success because I think they're doing the studio show, right?
Yes.
they have the potential to bring interviews back, which is really what you need. And if, I mean, you know, they say people need time in the ring. They need time in front of the camera, too. And I think Studio Show helps with that.
Very much so. Sean, your thoughts?
I've seen bits and pieces of it, but I will say this. I think the idea, they're onto something, because they're not – this goes back to what I just said about being a WWF junior. They're not. They're doing something different. They're providing a different type of product. So, again, I'm with Tony. You know, God bless you. I hope it does work. But I like the idea, though. I like that they're not trying to just do what everyone else is doing and try to do something completely different.
That is an outstanding point. You're right. They are doing something different. Now, I watched the first episode, and I liked it. And like you guys, I really hope these guys do well. The only reason I haven't watched the next two episodes is, hey, you know, it's baseball playoff time and it's football season. So I'll get around to it. Like I said, I liked it, but it came across a little bit as like a game show audience. And myself, I mean, I love studio wrestling as much as the next person. I remember when we first started getting WTBS in 1981, how cool and different I thought it was. But then by like 87, 88, I was like, this looks small time compared to what you're competing with, which was the WWF. But now I don't think these guys are competing with the WWF. They're just putting a product out there, which is really good. I liked it. And like I said, I'll continue to, you know, I'll get caught up when the time comes. And I really wish them well. It was fun seeing Jim Cornette out there doing commentary again. Sean, you've seen a little bit of it, so that's pretty much it.
I had a struggle to get to that.
Okay. Al Bledger, friend of the show, assuming they had not met with misfortune, would any of the Von Erichs have achieved success on their own? That means without their father running the territory. If so, which ones and to what extent? Tony, your thoughts.
Kerry, Kevin, and David would have all been main eventers. They would have been main eventers anywhere. The success they would have achieved would have been different. Kevin, he did very well in Georgia. People point to St. Louis. St. Louis is not a good territory to use as an example because Fritz was a gigantic star in St. Louis. He had a famous, you know, loser must retire match. But when these guys, when they went to, David went to Florida, Kerry did shots in Mid-South, he did shots in Hawaii, they did very well. Kerry would have been the superstar. The hype about David comes from people inside the industry, but the fans went crazy for Kerry because he was very 1980s with the physique, with the look, the charisma. I don't ever see Kerry on the level of a Flair or Hogan. I do see him a few notches below, like above Jake, but maybe hover around Savage. But Kerry, yeah, Kerry would have had great runs in WWF if Crockett wanted to book him properly, yeah. But they would have done well. They would have done well. The father, really, to be honest with you, I mean, you know, his father can give him the name, but, you know, they had to go out in the ring and actually, you know, perform. And if they couldn't perform, it would have been George Gulas.
All right, Sean, what do you think? Go ahead.
Yeah, you can paint it how, I mean, they gave them the opportunity, but you're not booking them into 15,000, 17,000, you know, people crowds over, you know, or whatever the crazy crowds that were getting at Dallas or at the Texas Stadium. I mean, they were all three of the first three were going to be successful wherever they went. I'm hard on Kerry for his in-the-ring stuff, but the charisma is unmistakable. I mean, that just jumps out at you, and he's absolutely a championship guy. The thing with David is that David more resembled an old-school type of champion, where Kerry represented kind of more of a modern champion. That's why most of the old-timers would have said, oh, David, because David was a five-tool guy. I mean, he could babyface. He had a good run in Florida as a heel. And, I mean, he could do kind of all that. And Kevin was outstanding in the ring before his knee started going out. I mean, in his early days, he could fly. So, yeah, those three, I think, with or without the father, they're going to be stars somewhere.
I agree with both of you that all three of them would have been big stars. And like both of you said, I mean, they got over outside of their dad's territory. They got over in Houston. They got over at Madison Square Garden. It would have been a really different look, like three guys with the same name all in the territories. And then when the war broke out and you had only two major promotions, like, you know, how many Von Erichs can Jim Crockett push? But it would have been interesting. I think at the end of the day, you know, they would have been successful no matter what.
Vince was desperate to bring them in 84. Yes. He made a lot of overtures. Vince was not going to book and lose money. If he didn't think they could draw money, he was never going to. It was never going to happen.
No, I agree with you. Yeah, you're right. I forgot about that. He tried very hard to bring them in, not just in 84, but 85 and 86 as well. Mm-hmm. I don't know if you guys remember, Ricky Steamboat worked the Cotton Bowl show in 1986. Yes. And they had a talent exchange preliminarily booked. And the story I got was when it was time for Vince to use Kerry, Fritz says, okay, it's a $25,000 a night booking fee. And that was the end of that.
Wow.
Yeah. Anyway, and this is 86 when the promotion is already heading south. So anyway, Max asks, had Tully and Arn not quit JCP in September of 1988 and stayed through 1989 as the promotion transformed into WCW, how would you have used them moving forward? Do the Four Horsemen go on into 1989, or would you have tried a new direction? Tony, what do you think?
Okay, some people might not like my answer to this because I love Tully. He was great. I paid a lot of money to see him at the Spectrum. Civic Center. And Arn, loved Arn, followed his career. But at that point in history, if you're asking me as a promoter, you know, with my money on the line, I would say, look, here's the deal. I'm going to call All Japan. I'm going to call New Japan. I'm going to try to get you 12, 16 weeks. When you're not working Japan, I'll pay you a retainer, not to go anywhere. But do this for a year, maybe a year and a half, and then I bring you back. Because you're stale, and the only thing I can do with you is move you down the card. If you don't want to take the deal, I'll give you your release. You go to Vince. I can't use you. I can't keep somebody I can't use, you know. And then I'm devaluing them. And they have a history. In 4 years, 5 years, 3 years, I can use them. But if I burn them out now, I'm hurting myself. So no, I that's the deal I would give them. I can't use you anymore. You've been, you know, Tully was 1984, so 5 years, held every title. He can't win the world title. He's not someone who can main event without support from somebody else. So no, they either had to leave one way or the other.
Well, I can't disagree with you, Sean. What are your thoughts?
That's actually a good idea, sending them to Japan, because Tony's right. They did need to get. I think there was a place, but this is where you miss the territory system. This is where you need to send them to, you know, Vern, or you need to send them to, you know, Barnett or something like that. Just get them away for like 6 months and bring them back fresh. That is exactly what you needed right now. The problem was that, you know, the Japan, I was trying to think, there's really no other option, because if you let them go, they're going to sign a contract. So you can't do that. But I think I would have offered the deal that Tony did. I think that's a smart idea, and make sure they get hooked up when they're there.
Okay, listeners, this is the pain of that I experience when I go third, because basically Sean and Tony have made all my points for me. I think, you know, Tully and Arn, where if you take yourself back to the fall or the late summer of 1988, they were painfully stale. The Horsemen were painfully stale. And Tony made a good point. You know, you needed – these were talented guys, but you needed to get away from them. They needed a break. Maybe you could have turned Tully and Arn babyface. And even though Tully is far from a traditional babyface, maybe you could have done something different with him being Tully until, you know, half the fans were cheering for him anyway. I think it was a Ric Flair thing. They were desperate to keep the Horsemen going. They were doing crazy stuff like having, you know, Kendall Windham as the junior Horseman and Bob Orton Jr. as, you know, a maybe Horseman, and Hiro Matsuda as the new leader of the Horsemen. I mean, come on, none of that's going to work. It had run its course. Also, Sean, you alluded to, I think one of Dusty's failures, if you want to call it that, is Booker. And I understand this. He was in a brave new world. There was no roadmap. It used to be like you send a guy to one territory and freshen him up and then maybe bring him back in a year or two. He could not do that in 1988. So it's either let the talent go to Vince, let the kid stay, or maybe come up with something creative like Tony did. Tony, any further thoughts from you?
Yeah, I think they needed to develop a farm team. I think that would have helped them. And I think that could have been a place not just to get guys ready for the big stage, but to send people that on the big stage were wearing out their welcome. Because you just can't have this. I mean, that's what killed Nitro. It was the same thing. I mean, and they had a million people, but eventually it just became the same faces over and over and over again. And you know, you've seen it before.
Yeah. Sean, any parting thoughts from you on that subject?
No, you guys pretty much covered it. I mean, you needed the territory to send them.
Yeah, I mean, that's the thing. It was I have sympathy for Dusty. It was hard. He was in a brave new world. Christian Bode, and I hope I'm pronouncing his last name correctly, asks, if Starrcade 87 is held in a traditional Crockett City and does well on pay-per-view, how different is history? Tony, we'll start with you.
They go out of business a year later. I mean, yep. It was not – the booking was bad. The booking was bad. It wasn't – you know, I remember when Dusty and Tully and Flair and Magnum were feuding, like back in 85, it was like, wow, it was something you'd never seen before. They were back again in mid 86 doing the same thing. I mean, they literally remade the Dusty Tully feud. Because in Philly, I remember they had like 4 or 5 months in a row where they faced over the TV title. It's like a year and a half later and they're back feuding over the TV title. You know, that was not going to change. And it was boring. It had become boring and it had become rehash. And it just would have got an influx of cash to keep them going. But the gates were going to go down.
I agree. Sean, any thoughts from you on this?
Them going to Chicago was a symptom. It showed that they were out of touch with their audience, that the bookie was getting bad, that they were getting stale. They were looking for something kind of to shake things up. We'll impersonate the WWF. Them doing the Chicago was just it wasn't the problem, but it was the decision to go to Chicago was the problem. The mindset to sit there and say, well, we should do this.
Yeah, I respectfully disagree with people. I know there are people who are passionate about this, who live in the Carolinas, that they feel like Starrcade was taken from them, you know, little by little. First it was North Carolina and Atlanta, and then they totally moved to Chicago. But here's the thing. It had become a national product. It was go national or go home. And they were doing well in Chicago. And I think this was their first pay-per-view. And they wanted to make it seem like as big a deal as they possibly could. I mean, had they done well on pay-per-view, it would have made a big difference short term. Because Crockett was counting on that pay-per-view money. He had been counting on it all year. In fact, I think he was borrowing against it. And when Vince McMahon, it was kind of an evil genius move when he not only put the Survivor Series on Thanksgiving night, but created a provision where the other promoters – Crockett was not allowed to have a show like either – I think it was 30 days before or 30 days after. I mean, that kind of – that was really the fatal blow that it was the number – it was the – like the – how do I put it? It was the fatal blow. I mean, they were dead less than a year later. Tony, any other thoughts on this?
Yeah, they needed additional revenue streams. And they could have done that with better marketing, T-shirts, posters, videotapes and all that. They really needed to get more. I mean, they needed to get additional revenue streams. And I think that they were short on cash. They needed that at the very minimum. But eventually it just was going to bridge them for so long before the poor quality of the product will drag them down. And then then all your revenue streams dry up.
Sean, any further thoughts from you?
No. I think it was just one more symptom of the thinking that was going to drive them out of business in a year. And that was going to happen no matter what.
You know, Tony brought up marketing, and I couldn't agree more that, you know, they put out these the videotapes that were – I mean, they just got too darn fancy with them, and too, they were too expensive. They priced a lot of people out. They would have brought in more money just going with a, something a little bit less complicated. And if you look at some of the T-shirts that promotion put out, man, I mean, I can't imagine why people bought them in the first place. I don't think they – it's like they didn't know what people wanted to wear. But anyway, Chris Berg writes, why were lighter weight class titles, for the most part, never able to get over in the United States like they do in Japan and Mexico? And he makes a good point about, you know, boxing having weight classes with guys like Leonard Duran and Hearns back in the day. Tony, your thoughts?
Well, the problem is no matter how great of a middleweight boxer you are, you don't want to go up against another boxer who's a pro who's 40, 50 pounds because he's going to drop you, even a mid-level boxer. Mm-hmm. The issue with wrestling, that's a big difference in Japan. The junior heavyweights were mostly given their own division with their own title. In the U.S., especially with the territories, you are going to have to mix up your junior heavyweights with your heavyweights in a worked match. And if your babyface is 40, 50 pounds lighter, you're going to be doing a lot of surprise wins, like a roll-up, which, you know, fans don't take seriously. Because I know that – I don't remember the exact match, but it was a tag match in New Japan. And Morocco ended up in the ring with the Cobra. And visually, it was a disaster. I mean, it just – it looked like a fake match. And they tried to book Flair with Tiger Mask. It just didn't work. I mean, All Japan, it just didn't work. And I think that's one of the reasons.
Excellent point. Sean, can you share your thoughts?
Well, in the territory days, there were a lot of places that relied on lighter weights. Memphis is one. Portland's another. Portland had some heavier guys, but they would go with lighter guys too. Southeastern was another. But your point is taken. This is an old boxing thing. This has been this way since the 1880s when John L. Sullivan jumped up on the stage at the Boston Opera House and screamed, "I can lick any son of a bitch in the house." Ever from then on until Mike Tyson, the boxing heavyweight champion, was considered the baddest man in the world. And that was how they promoted it. And that was, you know, that's basically how you were educated from as a boxing fan, that the heavyweight champ was the man. They had a famous scene in Raging Bull where LaMotta's De Niro playing LaMotta is looking in his hand. He goes, "I can never be Joe Louis." There you go. I mean, this is an old boxing thing, and good luck trying to get past it. And by the way, to take that example of Hagler, that was such an extraordinary group of boxers. You needed basically four all-time Hall of Famers to elevate them to the status they got to. You just have to have extraordinary talent to overwhelm the heavyweight division.
Yeah, I agree with what both of you guys said. I mean, it's just, you know what? Of all people, Jerry Seinfeld had the best insight about what pro wrestling is, or at least what it looks like to someone who's not a fan. Jerry Seinfeld said, you know, here's what pro wrestling is. We get a bunch of big guys. I mean, really big guys, and they pretend to fight. And that's what wrestling is in the United States. It's big guys and the little guy. You know, I'm not saying the smaller guys in WCW like 20, 25 years ago didn't get over when they had their separate division, but they were clearly portrayed as just not in the same class as the guys, you know, in the main events. Obviously, they're not in the main event. So there you go. Ron Gamble asks, Pat Patterson was the only challenger to get four Madison Square Garden matches against Bob Backlund. If you had any say, who would have gotten the final? Who else would have gotten four title matches at Madison Square Garden? Tony?
Terry Funk. Absolutely. Ooh. Because number one, you're going to have four sellouts because Terry Funk never went anywhere and didn't draw any money. But real important, Terry Funk played a tremendous part in Bob Backlund's career. Terry Funk put Bob Backlund over clean, center of the ring, on TV in Amarillo to put the Western States title on it. Terry Funk, Bob Backlund were close friends. They had many matches together. Funk defended the NWA title against Backlund twice. Perfect guy if you want to do four matches with.
I like that answer. Let me throw this in, too. I mean, Terry Funk was supposed to come to the WWF in 1980. I mean, the After magazines more than once like came out and announced that Terry Funk was on his way. I'm not sure what happened that detoured that, but I could definitely. And I was asked a long time ago by Mark Nolte. He said, you know, you up there with Terry Funk have gotten over. And I said, without question, definitely he would have gotten over huge. Sean, your thoughts?
That is a great answer, because Bob has a great scientific reputation, but his best matches were against brawlers, always. I mean, if you look at, I mean, with a couple of exceptions, but usually his best matches are against the massive monster heels. I'm actually, I didn't see the Backlund part, but I'm actually going to use San Martino here, and I'm going to say Arion. In 75, those crowds were still going up. You know, the first one was okay. Then the second one was crazier. Then the third one, you had the sellout at the Felt Forum. That crowd was wired to the point where the crowd became part of the event. I think you could have fit another fourth onto that 75 series with Arion easily.
Arion did a clean job in the second match, and they still sold out the third. That's impossible, but it happened.
And that crowd was nuts.
It reminds me a little bit of like Larry Zbyszko's turn, that they, you know, Larry was not a big deal until he turned on Bruno, and then he's the main event. If I had to pick one guy who could have gone four matches against Bob Backlund was a little bit over the top. I mean, there's a reason.
Can I interrupt one quick? This is important. I have this outlined right here. Quote, I already know John is going to yell about this, but I don't mind if a guy gets four if he gets rolling. I knew you were going to complain about a guy getting a four.
I thought four was excessive, and it wasn't even supposed to happen. But if I had to pick one guy who could go four, it would have been Magnificent Morocco in 1983, who I think only got two. But by that point, Morocco had been so established. He was the Intercontinental Champion. To me, he looked like a guy who was going to dethrone Backlund. Tony, any final thoughts from you on that subject?
Yeah, from my understanding, a lot of the big name NWA guys never went to Madison Square Garden because the promoters were a little leery, because you had to do the clean job. Terry Funk is a former NWA world champion doing a clean job on a televised, you know, cable channel show on the MSG Network. Oh, that wasn't going to happen. And Funk, when he was in the magazines, he pulled the stunt where he had the fake NWA title, was running around that he's the NWA championship claimant and all this. I think they were trying to work an angle with it, and with that one. And I don't think the NWA board was real happy with that angle. So there probably was some behind the scenes thing that was keeping him and keeping Dory and probably a few other guys out.
That's actually a really good point about Terry Funk and the NWA maybe not, you know, pulling the plug at the very last minute. Sean, any thoughts from you?
There was one family you never did see come in until the 80s. Was there a big reason for that? I mean, you never really did see any of the Funks come in until later on, when you would see a bunch of NWA guys come in on a regular basis.
I know Dory Funk Sr. and Terry worked Madison Square Garden, I want to say like very early 70s, but for the most part, yeah, they stayed clear. Next question.
I think it was an All Japan thing, too. I think All Japan might have been a little leery about that. And it's weird because WWF was an NWA territory, New Japan was an NWA territory, and All Japan was an NWA territory. But WWF had to deal with New Japan, and All Japan had to deal with I think the Funks were the talent bookers for All Japan for a while. I think there was just, you know, and Vince McMahon Sr. didn't like headaches. I mean, he just didn't want to deal with them. So if there was any drama, he was out. So I think that's probably one of the reasons.
That's my Ox Baker's rationale why he didn't last in the WWF. Anyway, Dan Circatella. Ask, who was Tony Garea's best partner, and why is the answer Dean Ho? That's a two-part question for you, Tony.
From what I saw, Dean Ho, he was great, but I didn't see enough of him, but I saw enough of Martel. I would have to say that Martel was Garea's best partner, but then again, you know, like I said, I didn't see as much of Dean Ho, but they were both great. They were both great.
So this is the Sean Goodwin tribute question. Sean, your thoughts on Tony Garea's best partner?
So basically, who do I like as the other guy? I was usually leaving the arena when Tony was on, so I'm not sure. But I do like Martel, and Dean Ho was really good. And I'll be honest with you, I can't remember any of the others. They always seem to have some
Haystacks,
other guy.
Calhoun.
Okay, yeah, why not? We'll have Haystacks. At least we get to see Haystacks and his like cow, but you know, whatever he had, the cowbell or whatever.
Haystacks Calhoun wearing the WWF tag team title is one of the most interesting visuals out there. He's kind of wearing it like a not really a necklace. But it's not around his stomach either. It was bizarre. I never saw Gurria, the Gurria and Ho tag team. I have seen Dean Ho in his later years, and he was still pretty good. I never saw Gurria and Calhoun together. I did see Zbyszko and Gurria, and they weren't great, but it was like a tag team that made sense. And when they finally won the titles, it was like, you know, oh my gosh, after 2 years of teaming semi-frequently, they finally won them against the Yukon Lumberjacks. The Rick Martel Tony Gurria team is a really good one. And I mean, I'm not even saying this in like a mean way. For a tag team that had Tony Gurria in it, that was an outstanding tag team. And Gurria held up his end. He did what he was supposed to do out there. He was the Robin in the Batman and Robin combination. We'll hand this over to you, Tony. Who was the best Anderson as an in-ring talent, and who was the worst?
A little tricky question, but I'll say the best first. I have to go with Ole, because Ole, no matter where you put him, Ole was going to main event as a heel and draw a lot of money. No matter where he should have been, a contender for Pedro or Bruno or Backlund, they would have made a fortune. No matter where you would have sent him, Ole was going to be on top. And Ole was great in the ring. He was believable. And he, you know, the man used an armbar. That's a rest hold. And he got the armbar over as a killer move because you believed him. Arn was great. Lars was great. Even Ole's son, you know, didn't have a long career, but he was very good in the ring. So I can't say anything negative about anybody with the name Anderson in-ring skill. But if you want to talk about somebody that if I had to put on top and really wanted to make money, I would go with Ole.
Now,
this is the but. Lars Anderson, 2 points in Lars Anderson's career kind of are strange. Lars was booked in St. Louis, and going by Larry Matizak's version of the story. Lars was given a finish, or a match was laid out to him, and Lars didn't want to do it. That's not something you do in St. Louis. And he goes to Muchnick's office, back and forth, you know. Not being, from my understanding, he's being professional about it. Muchnick shakes his hand and says, thank you for your time. And that was the end of Lars in St. Louis. You don't argue finishes with Sam Muchnick, you know. Lars also, for some reason, Lars shows up in 1976 in Los Angeles when the territory is on the way down. He's not Lars Anderson anymore, though. They gave him a gimmick. They changed his name to the man with the bionic arm. And he did a $6 million man gimmick. So the shtick was that he had, I guess, like the hands of stone, but it was bionic. He had a bionic, you know, I mean, it's one of those things you have a really hard time wrapping your head around.
I would say that I hated this question because I'm only counting Ole, Arn, Lars, and Gene because I don't know enough about the other guys. But Ole is a main event guy. Always believable. That was the thing about Ole, was it just he could make the simplest moves just look like they were agonizing. I'll just do the order. I have Arn right below, not by much. Ole had a little bit more kind of, you know, believability, which is saying something when you talk about Arn, because he did too. He's just right below. Lars is his own worst enemy. Lars very well could be one here. Except the fact that, you know, he's insisting on, you know, kind of like Thunderbolt Patterson and these guys who always kind of have some kind of a fight going on with somebody. Lars was always in the middle of some feud with some promoter, which is why he ends up in Los Angeles doing these gimmicks. He was also with Bulldog Brower in the ICW. But pretty much anytime you see some kind of break off outlaw organization, Lars is going to be showing up. But the question just said in the ring. In the ring, Lars is fantastic. I'm going to put Gene at the end only because I don't have enough Gene from when he was younger, when he was really good. The earliest stuff I have is from 76, and even then, he's starting to slip a little, you know, more than a little bit. So that's the only reason why I'm putting him there is I just don't have enough to, you know, to judge him any higher than that.
Who was the best Anderson as an in-ring talent? I'm going to say Arn, although I think Tony brought up some really good points about Ole. I mean, I remember the first time I saw Ole Anderson, it was 1980 in Florida, and he was feuding with Dusty Rhodes, and they brought that feud to Florida. And, you know, I was really – I'm like, oh, okay, here comes this tag team guy. And no way, he came across really strong as a singles. Maybe I missed the best year. I know I missed the best years of his career, but I would go Arn as the best individual performer. I mean, none of them were bad, but if I had to go, like, last place, it would probably be Gene. Andrew Wolf. What if Randy Savage had gone to the AWA instead of Memphis? I guess this would have been 1983. Your thoughts, Tony?
It starts out good, but then it doesn't end that way. What happens is speculation on my part. Savage was going to get over no matter where he went. Savage was not just a main eventer. He was a very special Hall of Famer type talent. He would have done well in the AWA. No question about it. The problem is when Savage got over in the WWF, it was unexpected. It was organic. The crowd just went crazy for him. He and Hogan had no history. If they were in the AWA together and they had the history together, Savage could have been a David Schultz and say, you know, this guy, he makes me look good. He's great. He's a great worker, blah, blah, blah. And, you know, bump around the ring for me, do this, and he'll take the leg drop, no problem. So Savage could have been boom, 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 pin, in 84. And then he's going down the card, you know, like Schultz.
I could see that. Sean, any thoughts from your end?
I'm thinking Savage pulls the turkey off the pole in 1990 and then actually cashes the check win the Team Challenge Series and revenge and drives the AWA into bankruptcy immediately. I think him and Vern would kill each other. This isn't an old Vern thing. This is an anytime Vern thing. I just don't think that Randy's personality, I think, would just drive Vern out of – I think they would kill each other. He lasts 6 months. He walks away.
If that. I mean, the AWA seems like a really strange destination for Randy Savage. I mean, he just – I think he would have been any promotion's type, but if you had to pick one promotion, that was – I mean, Vern was just very into his clean-cut baby faces or his, like, old-time guy, Baron Von Raschke, Mad Dog Vachon baby faces. And, you know, I'm not sure where Savage would have fit in there. But on the other hand, Randy Savage was such a unique – an amazing talent. Like, I can't help but think he would have gotten over anywhere he went. Just as a point of conversation, I got to see him when he first started with the WWF up in Manchester, New Hampshire at a hockey rink. And even though he wasn't really getting pushed yet, he'd just gone on TV. They hadn't given him Elizabeth. I just remember he was over like crazy. Anyway, our time is almost completely gone. I am going to answer one last question that was thrown to us by our old friend Randy Smith. Whatever happened to Harvey Cobb? I don't think anyone knows. Tony, thank you for taking the time to come on.
Yeah, thank you for bringing me on. I had a lot of fun.
All right. And I want to thank Sean for being my co-host and doing everything that he does. And I also want to thank Luke Kippelman, our producer. He does a lot more behind the scenes than people realize. And this has been a production of the Arcadian Vanguard Podcast Network. Go Vols.